Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jim.
The Bank of Canada has made its second rate cut. Does that keep us out of recession, or is it a sign that Canada is already in recession?
Well, the thing is that they are now concerned about the rising unemployment rate more than the receding inflation rate in Canada. So the fact that we have had our unemployment rate nationally rise 160 basis points already to 6.4%, and the projection is that it's going to continue to rise through this year. In fact, the long-term average unemployment rate is about 8%, so we're still historically below that significantly, but it's the rate of change, right, that's the problem. Part of that has come, as you know, from the increase in population that Canada has seen in the last couple of years, but the other part of that is from a falling work week and just businesses closing, less demand from consumers. Canadian retail sales have fallen, been contracting now for some time. So Canada is really struggling in, you know, by most measures worse than most economies, certainly worse than the U.S. data so far. The consumer in survey after survey, the Bank of Canada's recent survey found that most consumers are, you know, continue to cut their spending. They're pessimistic about their future economic conditions. They're concerned about their job loss. They're concerned about debts coming up for renewal, which, as we've spoke before, the problem there being that so much debt was taken out when interest rates were at rock bottom lows in the pandemic. People added, instead of using low rates to get out of debt, they doubled the amount of debt in, that they were holding in many cases. And so now that that stuff's coming up for renewal, the fact that the Bank of Canada has cut the overnight rate, its policy rate, which is the only one it actually has influence over, is the short term, which is sort of what banks base prime off of. So the Bank of Canada has lowered now from 5 to 4.5. The trouble is twofold there. One, these things work through the economy at a lag of a couple of years, as we saw when they started doing the tightening. It took until now, really, for that to be hitting. And so there was that two-year lag, which is pretty typical. And so any easing that's going to be done now in terms of the central bank policy rates is really not going to help for the next, at least the next year and possibly year and a half or 2 years before it starts to be felt. So really what you've got is this, the other second part of the problem being that as these pandemic debts come up for renewal, and that's, you know, throughout our private sector, both in corporations and households, we're the most heavily indebted private sector, of any major country. In fact, we are about as heavily indebted. I saw some data today actually comparing us to Japan at the peak of their property and real estate stock market bubble in the late 80s, that their private sector was about as indebted relative to their economy that Canada is today. And they went on to experience a couple of lost decades after that. So pretty troubling stuff. As I say, for the central bank to offer any ease or any assistance to these people that took out a lot of debt during the pandemic, they'd need to get interest rates, mortgage rates, that sort of thing, back down to where they were during the pandemic, which, you know, if, with the rate cuts that have happened already, the two half two quarter point cuts that have happened. The central bank rate, you know, has mortgage rates down to around 4.5, 5 in that area. Prime rates have fallen. I was just looking at, like line of credit rates and that sort of thing. They were about 11.5 before this cut. They're going to be about 11.2 now. The prime rate is down to about 6.7. Most banks lowered that in response to this cut. But that means variable rate mortgages are around 5.7, fixed rates around 5. You know, again, relative to the sub 2 that people were getting during the pandemic, that's not stimulative, right? That's still going to be a massive amount of increase in their payments. All of the time when we see 80% of new condo investors in Canada are reportedly losing money every month. I was just looking at some of the details on that. Again, because people paid too much during the pandemic, drove prices up an awful lot in a short period of time, refinanced or took out financing at rock bottom rates. And so, you know, even the standard two-bedroom apartment where people could rent potentially for $3,400 a month, if you look at the carrying costs of that, condo fees, you know, property taxes and a typical mortgage, you're talking about $5,400 a month just without any maintenance spending. So people are, 80% of new condo investors are losing an average of $600 a month, and more typically the median is around more than $1,000 a month that they're losing. So no wonder we've got things like condo sales at 27-year lows, and you know, the housing listings continue to balloon. There's this standoff between people wanting, you know, old prices that are no longer possible on current interest rates, and buyers who just either won't reach now that rates are higher, and or they feel that prices are coming down, but also, again, they just can't qualify. There's still not enough household income for most people to qualify for the price range that is on offer. So all of that to say, Jim, that yes, the economy in Canada is looking increasingly like it is in recession, and we may not know that for some time until it's backdated. But for the average working person or the average person trying to make pay their bills, it's a problem. And the Bank of Canada is really just counting on, and, you know, they were mentioning yesterday there's excess capacity in the Canadian economy. We're in a situation of oversupply in most things. That's a disinflationary trend. So in other words, that pushes, that doesn't allow for price increases. And in fact, on the asset side, if you've got too many people trying to sell and not enough people able or willing to buy, then that starts to be deflationary where prices fall. The Bank of Canada is just optimistically hoping that the labor market won't fall apart further. But this is where I say that's a tricky bet, because we know historically that once the central banks start cutting rates in response to a weak economy and rising unemployment, that they typically go on to cut about 300 basis points, so considerably more than is currently priced in, and the unemployment rate rises significantly through that time. So if we get the unemployment rising higher than, you know, the sort of 6.5 the central bank is hoping it'll stop at, I think the chances of it stopping at 6.5 at this point are very poor. And the more people have less work, then, you know, the harder it's going to be to make the payments. And we're already seeing defaults rise across the board.
Is the U.S. in motion to become in a recessionary state?
Well, again, this will be all backdated. Historically, we won't know this officially for some time, but they also have, you know, had things like the U.S. Conference Board of Leading Economic Indicators, which traditionally has been very prescient in telling us about coming recessions. It's declined for 30 months as of June, 30 consecutive months. That is, and it's now negative 14% from the cycle peak in December of 21. That's a broad basket of indicators that typically give a heads up on the direction of the economic activity. And we haven't had anything like this in terms of that 14% contraction without being in a recession since they started, you know, keeping this data since 1959. And the other thing that's, I think, you know, kind of concerning about the U.S. is that traditionally the longer you have things like the LEI falling, the basket of indicators falling, the longer it's been falling, the deeper the recession that follows. So the last time we had sort of a 20 months of contracting LEI was leading into the 2008 recession, and we all know that was called the Great Recession, being, you know, one of the worst in the modern era. The other thing is we have had this very inverted yield curve, which you and I have talked about before, where, you know, the as the central bank started hiking short-term rates back in March of 2022, by April, the short-term rates were higher than the long-term rates. So this kind of inverted yield curve has always also been a very reliable predictor of recessions. And again, the longer that you have the inversion, it's because it's normal to have short rates below long-term rates, right? Because that incentivizes long-term investment and typically is supportive of growth in the economy. When you get an inversion, it's there's less incentive to go long on anything and more incentive to just keep money in the short end. And that tends to be negative for economic expansion. So traditionally, when you've had that persist for a long period of time before a recession kicks in, again, the recession tends to be harsher than average. And we have had a very long period of inversion this time. And most importantly, we have now started to see that inversion come in or flatten out. So from a peak of about 108 basis points of spread, negative spread in that the yield curve inversion that happened at the peak of this, it's now almost flat. So just in the last month, a lot of that has happened where we've now got the 10-year rate is almost the same as the 2-year rate, as an example. So all of that matters, because when we get the re-steepening, that is usually coincidental with the actual onset of the recession. So the fact that we're there now, traditionally you get the recession starting within, you know, 0 to 9 months, the range is typically. So all that to say, yes, the CPI data, the PCE deflator this morning in the U.S. was stronger than expected, so that makes people nervous again about whether the central bank will wait longer to offer ease, because the U.S. Fed has not yet cut rates. And again, back to the point, you know, they're going to wait till they see a big jump in unemployment, which has already been rising. You know, we've got the highest level of repossessions, for example, in vehicles that we've had since the 2008 recession. They're up something like 23% year over year. Credit card defaults are up the most that we've seen since the 2008 recession. Like, there's a lot of evidence of struggling households and corporations. We've got junk debt spreads finally widening out. So the weaker borrowers are having to pay significantly more now when debt comes up for refinance. And that matters because we've got trillions of dollars in the corporate sector coming up again, where borrowed at very low rates and now having to face historically more normalized rates. And they're having a hard time finding someone to give them refinancing, which means they're unable to pay back. So they're starting to default. And that's not just in commercial real estate, that's in all kinds of debt. So all that to say that there's a couple of, this week, generally speaking, there was this feeling of that the Fed, the U.S., because the data has been weaker than expected in the last week or so, and there's been this sort of relief feeling in markets that, oh good, the U.S. Fed is going to have to cut now, and they'll probably go, you know, in September. And as of yesterday, they were thinking maybe they would cut 50 basis points. So that would catch them up to the move that the Bank of Canada has already made. But then, you know, you get some data, like I say, like the PCE deflator, which is the Fed's preferred measure of inflation today, coming in at 2.9 annualized, and that was higher than expected. So now, you know, there's this fear again that the Fed may use that as an excuse to wait longer and not cut in September. So each day we kind of get this push and pull back and forth of optimists for pessimists. But I think generally speaking, the data is mounting up on the negative side.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Facing the numbers that we've seen, anything that the average person can do, or is it just bite the lower lip and suffer through it?
No, I think, you know, eyes wide open, I like to say. So if you're, you know, depending on your circumstances, but if you came into this with a lot of debt and, you know, it's you're finding it difficult to meet your payments, or you're looking at a renewal date coming up where you're concerned that your rates of interest are going to rise, you know, even if the Bank of Canada, for example, does cut, you know, more at its next two or three meetings into the year end, will that be enough to relieve the stress that you're under is the question. And if the answer is no, then I think it behooves a person to look at how they can reduce their leverage. And that, if that means, you know, selling some assets, if that means reducing their exposure to real estate, you know, I know pricing is not very supportive right now, depending on the area. Some places, you know, if they're priced right, they are still selling. But generally speaking, this is not something that's going to be fixed in a matter of weeks or months. I think that the Canadian economy is going to get worse, and the amount of people that are motivated sellers is going to increase over the next year. So it's better to get ahead of that than to, you know, stay in denial too long and then be left with, you know, cash strapped or with liquidation mode where you have to take whatever price you can get, or, God forbid, hand things back to the lender and all that. So it is smart to be proactive in that, where possible to lower your expenditures, if you can pull in any of discretionary spending, and if you can increase your cash flow through other means of employment or maximizing your rental income or anything you can do to try and increase your cash flow, that's all productive stuff to do as well. And then on the savings side, you know, it's good to take advantage of the fact that you can get some decent interest rates now on savings. If you're able to take advantage of that, that's great. But making sure that you're not thinking that, so the big thing we've seen in the last little while is literally in the last week or so was this rotation where, you know, for a long time I've been talking about the fact that the S&P 500, which has been the best performing stock index in the world, has become very concentrated in a handful of tech names, right? And it was mostly on this AI mania, thinking that, you know, since ChatGPT came out a couple of years ago, this belief that AI was going to change everything and that, you know, it was just a super bullish story. Well, of course, you know, the question is, to what degree is it actually increasing and improving productivity today, and cash flow and revenue? What is the revenue model of all this? And, you know, you've got people like the Google CEO saying this week that the story is going to have to be a patient one. Like, it's not obvious that it's going to add actual either save money, like increase free cash flow. It's not obvious. It's very intensive and expensive investing in the AI expansion in the front end, with an uncertainty about how long it's going to take to have a payoff. So once that penny finally drops, then you start to see this sell-off starting in the tech names that have become obscenely priced. And as I said, most people are more exposed to that than they realize. They may think they're holding a you know, diversified portfolio, but actually if they've got a benchmarking similar to things like the S&P or the NASDAQ or any of these indices, they've got this extreme overweight in these particular sectors which have become so overvalued. And so all of a sudden, you know, in a matter of days, that handful of stocks gives back $1 trillion in market cap, and it starts to take the benchmark indices down with it. Now, we've seen this movie before, as I like to say. We saw it, for example, in the tech wreck of 2000, and back then as well, the Fed was just starting, you know, the stock market peaked in March, and the Fed didn't start cutting rates until later, several months after that. But even then, you get these relief rallies where, you know, the stock market celebrates the fact that the Fed is finally going to start easing, without any recognition of the fact it's going to take a long time for that to actually feed through into the economy. And so initially you see this knee-jerk selling of the highly valued tech stuff and going to what people call relative value plays. So you hear a lot of people talking about, you know, well, if you're going to be in equities, you should look for dividend paying stocks. You should go to defensive sectors, this kind of thing. But the reality is that those sectors also fall a lot in this environment, both because they're interest sensitive, but also because they are also dealing with, you know, a low growth environment or a contracting economy. Those companies all have difficulty with their financing as well. Revenues start to fall, you know, so it's not like any one sector in particular. Like in Canadian retail sales, 9 out of 10 sectors saw disappointing results. So it's broad-based. It's across the whole economy that this impact comes. So you shouldn't think that hiding out in certain sectors or equity weights are going to be particularly protective of your principal. And so that's why I like to say to people, have a look at how much of your savings is currently allocated to the stuff that falls in this environment, and make sure that you're not going to be needing some of that savings to shore up your own income statement in this environment, or, you know, fund some expenditure that you've already committed to or have to do, or building a house or something that you've already committed in your mind you need X dollars for. Make sure that you don't have the money you need for that in these assets that are likely to fall in this environment. And so all of that is kind of like a big picture overview, but there's lots a person can do rather than be helplessly hit by this.
And Danielle, before we go, we do have a listener question from David. If interest rates are likely to remain stable or drop, do ETFs make sense, or are they too high risk? Does the covered call mitigate the risks?
Yes, he's talking about covered call bond ETFs there. And so it's a little bit complex, but that's basically a fund that holds allocations to other bond ETFs typically, or sometimes the bonds themselves. And what they do is they sell call options to generate more income in addition to the income that's coming off the bonds. So, I mean, again, it depends what kind of bonds are inside the portfolio. If they are corporate or junk, that's not the kind of thing you want to hold in this environment. If they are holding government bonds, that can be the correct asset to hold in this type of an environment, with the caveat that it depends, like, the longer the duration of the asset, 20 and 30 years, the more volatile that's going to be in terms of the market price moving around. Whereas if you hold sort of, you know, 3 to 10 year bonds, that's going to be less volatile in terms of the price swinging around. So basically, yes, these type of bond ETFs can be better than owning equity ETFs in this environment. It's just that sometimes there's other strategies going on inside, whether they're hedging, whether they're holding U.S. Bonds or Canadian bonds, whether the person is from Canada or from the U.S. So there's a lot of complexity around it. And it's the tricky bit is that I don't know that the average person is equipped to, you know, look at what's actually happening inside the fund and make that kind of decision. The idea about, you know, selling calls to increase income is great, but that doesn't, calls themselves do not protect you from the assets themselves falling. So if interest rates are likely to remain stable or drop, then typically, yes, government bonds go up in price, but other types of bonds fall in that environment. If interest rates rise drastically, then the opposite impact, right, where bond prices will fall as interest rates rise drastically. And we definitely saw that in 2021 into 2023. And if you're leveraged, if the fund itself is leveraged inside, then that can be magnifying that both ways. So generally speaking, it's too complicated to give someone an answer of yes or no, that whether that's appropriate. They'd have to do more work in terms of their overall risk exposure, their portfolio, and they'd need some expert input in terms of what the actual fund is doing.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. As you just heard, she will answer your questions. You can send them to info@HowStreet.com, our YouTube channel, Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.